It's just past 8:34 in the morning, and you're listening to Upfront. I'm Antonia Yuhas. As Hurricane Florence crashes into the Atlantic coast, we continue now with part two of our deep dive into the recovery process still underway from just one of last year's major hurricanes, Hurricane Harvey. On August 25th of last month, a People's Tribunal on Hurricane Harvey recovery was held in Houston, focused on the impacts of those in the hardest-hit communities, particularly low-income communities of color within the area's petrochemical hubs, looking not only at impacts from the storm, but also historical issues of environmental racism and injustice, and the path towards establishing a process of just recovery, not only in Houston, but across frontline communities. We continue now with Patricia Gonzalez, who founded her own organization called Caring for Pasadena Communities. Thank you for speaking with me today. Tell me your name, please.
Patricia Gonzalez.
And where do you live?
In Pasadena, Texas.
So tell us about Pasadena, what the community is like, who lives there, and what you're surrounded by.
Well, I'm surrounded by a lot of petrochemicals, refineries. All these refineries, they flare so bad at night. When Hurricane Harvey hit, you know, a lot of those streets flooded. All that got flooded and went into the residential areas. And that's what scares me so much, that the people ended up getting these chemicals into their yards, into their houses, and they're still not fixed. They need to still be repaired. Right now, Pasadena is predominantly about 64% Hispanic. There is some that are undocumented.
Tell me about what it was like on the days during the storm, because we've seen the data now that Valero released these just toxic plumes filled with benzene. What was it like during those days?
We try to tell everybody not to be outside when it's cloudy or when it's drizzling, because that's when they're flaring. People started realizing, they started seeing it, and then they started feeling the headaches, the nosebleeds, the chest pains, the problems breathing, and then they also smelled these horrible smells. And they put two and two together, and they're getting it. They're starting to understand it. We also try to get Air Alliance to help us out by putting some monitors on the fence line, especially by the high school, Pasadena High School. The dropout rate at that high school is so high, and it's hard for these students to catch up and graduate. And I'm trying to get them to understand it. When there's flares or the stacks are going, put two and two together. These kids are getting sick, and that's why they're missing school. So that's why with Air Alliance, we're able to get those readings and say, you know, you're actually going beyond what you're supposed to be releasing.
And that's on just under regular operations. So then during the storm, they had this unpermitted excessive release, and you could see the flares and you could smell the smoke. Did anyone from Valero come and warn the community? Did anyone from the city come and warn the community before, after, during?
No, they didn't.
Most of our listenership is in California. They've experienced earthquakes. They've experienced fire. Hurricanes aren't something that they know about. And they also don't live mostly in communities that are they're surrounded by this type of pollution. Can you help sort of, for your experience, help us understand that day, the day of Harvey, then the week of Harvey, what it was like dealing with this, also this, you know, intensified set of problems, which was Valero and its pollution. What was it like for you?
It was very chaotic. People just, they looked like they didn't know what they were doing, what to do for themselves. You saw that they were trying to get the water out of the homes as the water was trying to recede, but they still had this sense of, I'm smelling something. You know, it stinks. Is it harmful for me? You know, I'm feeling nauseous. I'm dizzy. My eyes are burning and I'm hacking up, and you know, my kids are having problems breathing, and a lot of the children have asthma problems. It's nothing for a nurse to have 10 to 12 inhalers in her drawer at the schools, at any given school that you go to, because the asthma rate is so high in Pasadena. And even my two children, when they were going to school there in Pasadena, they had their inhalers in the nurse's office, and I always had to take it there. But when they went to go to school in college in UT in Austin, they didn't have to have their inhalers anymore because they were away from the refineries.
I found out today that the oil companies have asked the state of Texas, and the state of Texas is now asking the federal government for taxpayer money, about $70 billion, to protect the oil companies, the refineries, from the next storm. What do you think about that?
I don't think that should happen. If anything, the communities are needing the protecting, not the refineries, because they make millions in profits every day.
What is the long-term solution? Do you hope that the Valero and the other facilities will shut down? Do you hope that the people who live in Pasadena will be able to move somewhere else? What do you hope happens in the long run?
In the long run, I would wish that no refineries be around any living human or animal or schools or anything like that within a 25-mile radius.
What do you feel the importance of holding a people's tribunal is?
I think the importance is that these organizations get to know each other, because one head is okay that wants to fight, but when you put a group of people that really are ready to fight, then you've got a game plan.
When the tribunal came to an end, the participants headed to the historically African-American Third Ward of Houston, where they gathered in New Waters Co-op. Co-op founder Carmen Jules spoke with me at the start of the gathering.
We're standing here in the middle of a co-op in the Third Ward of Houston, and people are shopping and checking out all the different displays that are here, the bookstore, and I'm speaking with one of the organizers of the co-op.
Yeah, founder.
Founder of the co-op.
Yes, my name is Carmen Jules.
And Carmen, let's start with Hurricane Harvey. How was this area impacted by the storm?
Well, one of the wonderful things is directly, most of Third Ward didn't have a direct hit because of the way it's designed. And so what we did is we opened the co-op. We were here throughout the hurricane, and people were like, how are you able to do this? And we were open, and we were making it happen. We supplied disaster recovery teams. We helped families. We provided food every day, except for the first day that the hurricane hit, because we didn't know just how difficult it was going to be. But once we got here and we opened our doors, we made a big pot of coffee because people were traumatized by the storm. So they could come in and they could feel comfortable, a little bit of connection to community, which is what co-ops are all about. We also, during the hurricane, handed out 1,000 sandwiches right on the corner. People driving by, people who were traumatized. We just wanted them to have a moment where they could have a really good little meal and remember that people really care. Because people had this like blank stare on their face and they're like real traumatized. So then we had the ability to give disaster recovery funds to each of our families, $150 per person and a $20 travel stipend for the bus so they could get to and from work. And it was really a difficult time. Cars were flooded, but it was a magnificent effort because this is the little co-op that could. We have like no money, and we were able to help 21 families for 90 days. That's like so amazing. And then we worked really well with a disaster recovery team. So now we're more proactive. What we did is we've trained all of our volunteers on disaster recovery, what they can do personally and at home. So if they can't get to the co-op, they can work in their communities and really do something. So we're fundraising now to get disaster recovery team equipment like life vests, gloves, hard hat, boots, and we want to have at least two flat bottom boats. And then we can have a team that can actually go out there and rescue and bring them out. But we're going throughout the community and saying, hey, Hurricane Harvey taught us something. There's not going to be a whole big team to come and rescue you. So we're making an effort where everybody goes out and buys one of those rubber rafts for the number of people in their house, take it to the park and go to the pond and practice rowing that boat and get life vests and waterproof backpacks so they can get a change of clothes, because we educate the community that once you get in that floodwater, bacteria sets in. If you have a cut or something, it's all kinds of bacteria. So we recommend that they decontaminate and put fresh clothes on the moment you get to dry land. So we're really proactive working and educating now from a proactive stance versus a reactive stance.
Tell listeners about the Third Ward of Houston. Who lives here? What's it like here?
The Third Ward historically has a strong cultural, music, huge economic self-sufficiency. And then it went through a time period where everything kind of shut down. Actually, integration kind of shut everything down in the community. In this community where
it's historically African-American community.
Historically. And then in this community alone had 6 grocery stores that were supplied by our farmers. Well, then all of a sudden the farmers are gone, the grocery stores are gone. And so I went to the community. I said, look, we don't have a lot of money, but I came up with a plan. Let's pull our monies together. Let's open a store in the community and let's put a store back on the corner in one of the major thoroughfares. And they said yes. And it's been a labor of love. We haven't had a lot of money, but we've had a lot of support from people and a lot of lessons, because in food deserts and economic deserts, it's almost like sometimes we kind of hinder our own growth and advancement. And so we're really educating about food, about economics, and about culture.
You've got, I see, solar panels, a solar team. Talk about the focus on green energy.
Whoa, wow. We love solar. Our farm is off-grid. We have lights that were donated that have solar lights that we can work day or night at the farm. We have a tiny house project where we're empowering people to have housing and to do it at whatever level they are. You know, don't feel like just because you've been forced out that there's no way or no hope. We give hope where there isn't as far as housing and power. And so we're a strong proponent of solar energy. I took a team for training, and 10, 15 people that had never even thought about solar went, learned how to install it, and how it will help them with their tiny houses. So, you know, we don't want to overwhelm people. We want to take it one step at a time. But we're like really, really powerful into solar.
Thank you. Thanks very much. I appreciate it.
Yes, thank you. Thank you for coming out, too.
And finally, a discussion of just recovery from an organizer who has firsthand experience from Katrina, the BP Deepwater Horizon disaster, and is now organizing across hurricane-impacted communities.
Hi, my name is Joysha Dutta. I live in New Orleans, Louisiana, and I am the strategist for the Story Shift Project at Working Films and part of the Another Gulf is Possible collaborative. We are launching the Stories of Survival tour, first leg of that tour here on the first observance of Hurricane Harvey, and had been talking, you know, Brian Badas is one of our partners in the Story Shift Project, as is a bunch of folks who are living in climate-impacted places, specifically dealing with just recovery issues from hurricanes. And so the Gulf South is obviously where I've been working and advocating and for the last many years now. But after what happened in Puerto Rico, and we've already been talking about how do we connect the struggles across the Gulf Coast and thinking of the Gulf Coast as an ecosystem, not just environmentally, but socially and culturally, economically. And so this idea of doing this tour when we have these observances during hurricane season to kind of tie together and the exchange that is already occurring of stories of people who are coming up with solutions for their communities instead of kind of always retelling the victim narratives. We want to tell the stories of survival and the stories of self-determination, the stories of, you know, how people, every time these hurricanes happen, we see the same pattern. We see the government neglect. We see the big nonprofits sucking up all the money. And then we see what happens. We see people helping each other one-to-one. And, you know, you talk to Miss Carmen here in New Waters, this co-op that we're at, and she talks about the 21 families that she helped, that this co-op helped themselves. Nobody told them to do it. Nobody. They did what they needed to do to help their own people. You talk to all sorts of folks in Houston, that's what people did. That's what people did in Katrina during, you know, in New Orleans. Next weekend, we're going to be there. It's 13 years later. We still have recovery issues in New Orleans. We still have a lot of the same, you know, if a hurricane like Katrina happens next month, I don't trust that we won't find the same exact pattern again happening, you know, in Puerto Rico, not to speak of the atrocious situation that's happening with our Boricua brothers and sisters. And so we'll be going there leading up to the 1 year of Maria. Also at the same time is the Global Climate Action Summit. So we're also intentionally trying to, you know, with our partners, and, you know, we're part of Climate Justice Alliance, right? Like, they're actually a supporter, funding, helping to fund this Stories of Survival tour. So this is, in a way, the frontline series of events that are intentionally happening at the same time as all the things happening in California, but we're actually going to the front lines. And hopefully there's, like, mutual amplification back and forth between what's happening, you know, in California and all the kind of conversations that are at that kind of very policy big level, to talk about what's happening on the ground, what people are suffering, and the solutions that they're coming up with.
How big is that disconnect between the policy think world, the NGO world, and the on the ground organizing that you're talking about?
I wish that it was, I wish that rhetoric married action. You know, I actually feel like the rhetoric of the NGOs and of even of government and policymakers has gotten a lot better, right? Like, the words people say and the words that are used sound better. You know, they're much more aligned with, you know, values I believe in. But then actual practices haven't changed, right? Actual extractive ways in which the NGOs operate, even media makers operate. Part of the whole Story Shift project is really intended to kind of shift the power of who's telling whose stories and trying to resource people on the ground with good equipment, right? With resource, with space, with money, with to tell their own stories, you know? Because a lot of times the reason people aren't able to or aren't taken seriously is because they have low production value, this, that, the other. So I feel like we are trying in our way to model how you move from rhetoric to action, right? Like, we have a set of principles and praxis, which was our words that we started with, and now we're trying to put those words into action with this, you know, current tour, and then we're going to keep kind of iterating and moving forward, because it just seems like we keep moving, we keep seeing the same pattern of good words, but then when disaster strikes, the same things happens, and we know who's left behind. It's the, you know, Black, brown, and poor folks. Like, that's, it just keeps happening over and over and over again. So how do we actually not wait for government, not wait for the NGOs? How do we start to create our own self-determined spaces, our own resources, our own structures and systems? A space like this is really inspiring to me, you know, where we are right now. You know, clearly this community in this, you know, literal room that we're in right now are trying to do that for themselves. And we have some spaces like that in New Orleans. Puerto Rico is on their way. Like, there's some amazing work happening there. So, like, how do we really build that up and not wait for the government and not wait for the NGOs?
In addition to Just Transition, which is something that I think a lot of folks are familiar with now, Just Recovery is not as familiar. Can you talk about the basics of Just Recovery, what it means to you?
In Puerto Rico in particular, I think this idea of Just Recovery is taking hold in a way that we didn't know a year and 4 days ago when we birthed the term. You know, making sure those that we know are going to be impacted first and worst by these hurricanes, and those who are going to be least likely to access the readily available resources, are the most prioritized for just recovery work, right? So that there is intentional and thoughtful structures and systems in place to make sure those are the folks who are actually at the top of the list instead of the bottom of the list. Would probably be like a basic way to frame the relief part of it. And then I think the long-term recovery part of it is the same, similar thing. How to make sure that resources, the structures and systems are built for those who don't have the homeowners insurance because they're renters, or who don't have flood insurance because it was too expensive, or don't have healthcare and yet they were exposed to really toxic sludge when the water came into their house, right? Like, all of those things, that those are the people that are prioritized in the long-term recovery.
Thank you. Thanks so much.
Thank you. Thanks, Antonia. Thanks for always having our back out here.